This time on your weekly Constitutional, Abraham Lincoln, the ethically constrained president.
Well, his dilemma was that he wanted to act against slavery. He saw slavery as morally inconsistent with the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, but he also was constrained by the U.S. Constitution in what he was able to do. And so he had both an oath to uphold the Constitution and a personal opposition to slavery, and that left him with an ethical dilemma.
That was Daniel W. Stowell, the former director and editor of the Papers of Abraham Lincoln. It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week it's about presidential ethics. What a concept.
It's time for your weekly Constitutional, a weekly discussion of interesting constitutional issues, from gay rights to gun rights. YWC is produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier, and is hosted by Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at Lincoln Memorial University's Duncan School of Law in Knoxville, Tennessee.
Among other things, I wear the hat of the Associate Director of the Abraham Lincoln Institute for the Study of Leadership and Public Policy at Lincoln Memorial University. What's that old adage? The longer your title, the less important you are. No, the Lincoln Institute is a fine institution, and it does some important things. One of them is the annual R. Gerald McMurtry Memorial Lecture that we hold every fall, either in late October or early November. There are several past McMurtry Lecture interviews on our website, so please Google your weekly Constitutional, find our podcast hosting site, or find us on iTunes or Spotify, and you can go back and find those other episodes. This year, in 2019, the McMurtry Lecture was given by a fellow who's eminently qualified to talk about Lincoln. His name is Daniel W. Stowell. He's the former director and editor of the Papers of Abraham Lincoln. And he told us all about a terrible dilemma that Abraham Lincoln faced.
My name is Daniel Stowell. I am an independent scholar right now working with manuscript dealers to contextualize historical documents from Christopher Columbus to the 21st century. I, for 20 years, was a member of the team and then the director of the Lincoln Legal Papers and then the Papers of Abraham Lincoln in Springfield, Illinois. And we gathered thousands of documents from Lincoln's law practice and then from his pre-presidential and presidential political career.
So, like, this makes you an expert on Lincoln, kind of?
You could say that.
Okay,
you could say
that. And right now you're a treasure hunter, right? You go around the world, you know, going into catacombs and finding rare manuscripts and then selling them for millions of dollars.
No, I generally look at them and tell you why they're significant or important, and then people buy them.
So you're not Indiana Jones.
I'm not Indiana Jones.
You're the guy who prices his stuff. Okay. Tremendous. Well, you are 2019 McMurtry Lecturer. You also have the distinction, I think, of being our very first McMurtry Lecturer. What, do you recall what year that was? About 10 years ago?
I think it was about 10 years ago. I'm not absolutely certain of the year.
We've been doing this lecture for about a decade, and you did it when it was up in Harrogate, right?
Yes.
Okay. We have since moved it from the main campus down here to the law school, and for the last 3 years, including this one, we have offered a three-hour CLE, Continuing Legal Education, extravaganza, all focused on Lincoln, or mostly on Lincoln, and his ethical dilemmas, of which there were many. And you, who is likely the world's leading expert on Lincoln's law practice, with all due modesty, you don't brag on yourself too much, but you certainly have a basis for doing so. And you came and told us about a very particular ethical dilemma he faced, not as a lawyer, but as president. What was that dilemma?
Well, his dilemma was that he wanted to act against slavery. He saw slavery as morally inconsistent with the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, but he also was constrained by the U.S. Constitution in what he was able to do. And so he had both an oath to uphold the Constitution and a personal opposition to slavery, and that left him with an ethical dilemma.
So in other words, Article 2 doesn't let the president do anything he wants to do. Article 2 gives the president certain powers.
Absolutely.
And in fact, very large powers. But nonetheless, he is subject to the rule of law.
He is. And Lincoln was a strong believer in the rule of law. had always been, from his first political speech in 1838 all the way to his last pronouncements before his assassination. He was a firm believer in the rule of law, in the Constitution, in the constitutionally imposed limits on power and the balance of power. And so he was not willing, even to in opposing slavery, to transgress those boundaries.
And that's an extremely important point. As you said, he hated slavery.
He did.
He wanted to abolish it, I'm sure, in his heart of hearts. But he did not feel that even as president, the single most powerful individual within our government, that he had the ability to do so.
Right. And for much of the early part of his presidency, he believed his only option was to try to convince slave states that had remained loyal to the Union to abolish slavery on their own, even if that meant the federal government would subsidize that through payments to these states to compensate slave owners. But it would get rid of slavery in those key border areas. And of course, this is what slave owners in the Confederacy feared the most, was the gradual chipping away of this institution.
Let's back up. Let's establish first Abraham Lincoln's bona fides in terms of being anti-slavery. Because, of course, I'm sure you've heard many people argue, cherry-picking quote here or there, that Lincoln actually wasn't anti-slavery, that this was all some sort of, I don't know, historical fluke or something. Tell us about Lincoln's anti-slavery feeling.
Well, he had always considered slavery to be morally repugnant. And in fact, he wrote to one of his close friends, Joshua Speed, about a trip that he had made to Speed's home in Kentucky. And on his return trip, he saw some slaves shackled together on the Ohio River being sold south. And he used that illustration to explain to his friend Speed, who was himself a slave owner, how much he, Lincoln, and other Northerners crucified their feelings, those are Lincoln's words, every time they saw slaves and slavery up close and personal in that way. And so Lincoln had always opposed slavery. He found it to be both morally repugnant, but also unfair, because these people, enslaved African Americans, did not benefit from the fruits of their own labor. Mm-hmm. And Lincoln was a firm believer that people should be allowed to rise as far as their abilities and their hard work would allow them.
Let's pause on that image for just a moment. I've read about that, of course, about the riverboat trip and seeing that he was a young man then. He was, what, 19
yes.
or 20 years old?
Something like that.
And these were the first slaves he had seen up close and personal, I think. Maybe he'd seen some others, but this is the incident that he most frequently recounted. But he came from a strong anti-slavery background. Wasn't his father Thomas also anti-slavery?
Well, his father had moved from Kentucky to Indiana in part to escape slavery, in part to escape the complicated land titles in Kentucky. Mm-hmm. So there, I don't want to characterize him as being solely anti-slavery, but he certainly was part of a group that believed in free labor. Mm-hmm. And again, we don't want to be too overly simplistic here. Just because you're in favor of free labor doesn't mean you necessarily care about slaves. There were lots of Northerners who wanted the territories to be free of slavery because they wanted the area for themselves. They didn't particularly care about slaves, but they didn't want to compete with slave labor.
Yeah, that is an issue here. That's a real issue that we often overlook. If I'm a laborer, which most people are,
right,
or even if I own some land, I'm still, for the most part, working my own land. And so primarily what I'm selling is my labor.
Correct.
And if the guy down the street has 10 slaves who can do 10 times the amount of work I can do, and he basically gives them subsistence, bare subsistence in very, very primitive conditions, then their labor is much cheaper than mine. And how can I compete on the open market? So
right.
It undercuts me. So even if I'm being completely selfish,
correct,
I can be anti-slavery on that basis, or I can be object to it as well on a moral ground, for example, which apparently Lincoln says he did. But he came from, at least to some extent, an anti-slavery background. Mm-hmm. And then that image, again, sticks in my mind. I have never seen people shackled. But when I try to think of it, I guess I've seen it in the movies once or twice.
Sure.
It's a very disturbing image. The closest I can think of, Daniel, is when I took a trip to East Berlin in 1979, when there still was an East Berlin, and West Berlin was surrounded by a wall and machine guns and all of that. Went over and visited, spent the day talking to people who were regular old human beings, just like you and I are. And then I got to leave.
Right.
And they did not. And around me were tearful families being separated. And it occurred to me that those people behind that wall were being kept there like zoo animals. Mm-hmm. And it was a very striking image that sticks with me to this day. Even more so, the lot of the slave. I mean, literally in shackles, on a boat. What would have happened if the boat went down? They would have drowned. Their property. I sometimes wonder if when we do these historical reenactments that we should be even more realistic about the slave markets and the conditions they were in. On the other hand, I think that might be just too painful for too many people.
Yeah, when I think of shackles, the only time that I really think of shackles in today's world is someone, let's say, who's accused of murder mm-hmm. and may come into a courtroom shackled.
Right.
But that's someone having at least allegedly done something terrible, and they're shackled for it. But these people were simply born. They were born.
There's no fault.
And that was their crime. They were born in a race that was systematically enslaved. And that makes all the difference when you're considering the mental image of them being shackled.
Exactly. You get to walk away and they don't.
Exactly.
You get to get up and stretch your legs and they don't. You get to be a human being, a full human being, and they don't. That's really striking. So Lincoln was talking about the emotional impact seeing slaves had on most Northerners, or many Northerners. But then the Southerners had a very different view of this, didn't they? I've read that people like Speed were actually proud to be able to walk down the street attended by slaves because it was like having a nice suit of clothes. I mean, it indicated that you're wealthy, right?
Yes, there were certainly Southerners who believed that. I mean, we have to always be careful about gross simplification conglomeration of all opinions. There were Southerners, white Southerners, who were desperately conflicted about slaveholding. Mm-hmm. Henry Clay is a classic example.
The great compromiser.
The compromiser. Arguably, he and a few others postponed the Civil War through some of the compromises that they were able to reach in the 1840s and 1850s. And we could question whether those were morally good compromises or not, but they were compromises that postponed a sectional conflict that eventually erupted in 1861.
It's a Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week my guest is Daniel W. Stoll, the former director and editor of the Papers of Abraham Lincoln. And guess what? We're talking about Abraham Lincoln. You're listening to your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and my new buddy Dan Stoll is telling me all about a terrible ethical dilemma that Abraham Lincoln faced. On the one hand, he'd taken an oath to uphold the Constitution. On the other hand, he hated slavery. He didn't think the Constitution gave him the power to abolish slavery, and so what's a president to do? Well, attitudes like Lincoln's and dilemmas like his were not uncommon in those days. Many people thought very deeply about slavery, and it wasn't always black and white.
I mean, if you read what Thomas Jefferson wrote about slavery, the wolf by the ears, these are not slaveholders who are proud to be slaveholders and feel that they have every right in the world to do it. They're conflicted, they're troubled in their consciences and so forth. Now, I'm not saying that there weren't slaveholders who were arrogant enough to believe that it was their God-given right to own other human beings as slaves. They were there too. It's just all of these people were not the same.
Right.
Just like today, all people are not the same. So I think, yes, there was a certain amount of pride, a certain amount of honor. A lot of people even, and this is one of the harder, I think, challenges for us to wrap our heads around in the 21st century, there were people who didn't own slaves, whose parents didn't own slaves, who still supported slavery to the point of going and serving and dying in Confederate armies because they believed that no matter how hard their lot in life, no matter how poor they were as Scrabble farmers, at least they weren't slaves. Mm-hmm. There was somebody beneath them in the social order, and they could feel some sense of superiority or success or however you want to describe it, in not being slaves. And that's where your sense of Southern honor comes in, and the sense of, well, at least I am part of a race that is superior to this other race, even if I'm a dirt farmer.
Isn't that remarkable how much we care about the social pecking order? Even those of us who say we don't,
Right.
That's typically because we occupy a privileged position. I mean, you and I are very fortunate to be where we are. We're both professionals. We both have the leisure to sit here and talk about these interesting issues in this beautiful old law school. So it's easy for somebody like you or like me to say, oh, I'm not worried about those things. But somebody who's on the low end of the scale, and he looks around and he's constantly being told that he's not worth much. Well, at least he can point to these other people and say, but I'm worth more than them. I'm reminded of a comment by Lyndon Johnson, who was asked about that same phenomenon. And he said, much more salty language than I'm going to use. It's something to the effect of, if you tell a poor Southern white that he's better than those people, he'll give you anything. He'll empty his pockets for you because that appeals to his ego.
He'll join the Confederate Army.
Or they'll join the Confederate Army 100 years earlier.
Correct.
You brought that point up. You credited your thesis advisor for bringing that up when you were asked the question, which was, why in the world did the Southern states secede? So let's fast forward a few years from Lincoln's youth. He's got a long history and all the years in between of being anti-slavery. And he gets elected to the presidency in 1860 as the representative of the new Republican Party, which is by and large an anti-slavery party. I mean, that's their basic reason for being. And he gets elected, and is he going to go and immediately abolish slavery? Is that what he claims he's going to do when he gets to be president?
No, and that's an important distinction that we often gloss over. As we look back 150 years on that period, we think anti-slavery means, okay, they're going to do everything in their power to pass laws against slavery immediately and free all the slaves. And that's an abolitionist view. Mm-hmm. It's not an anti-slavery view. The distinction is important. The Republican Party was absolutely an anti-slavery party, but their primary goal upon election was to restrict the expansion of slavery into federal territories, into new states, believing that slavery, if contained, would die out under its own weight. They believed it was an inefficient system, it was an unjust system, and it would die of its own internal contradictions.
Let's pause there for a moment. The constitutional basis for this, which Lincoln, of course, was very up on, was that he knew, he'd read the Constitution. It protected slavery up, down, and sideways. Several different provisions in there, including some that could not be amended according to their own the terms of the Constitution. The infamous Three-Fifths Clause, the Fugitive Slave Clause, the ban on banning the slave trade, the international slave trade, 20 years after the Constitution was ratified. All of these things were really in the DNA of the Constitution, and there was no positive power on the part of the national government to change internal state law on that subject.
Right.
However, the Constitution also provides, I believe it's in Article 4, I'll have to double check after we finish here, that when new states are going to be admitted to the Union, that's a matter that's left up to Congress to a great extent, especially when we're talking about expanding into new territories. And so Congress would then pass statutes and say, okay, you can come in under these conditions. One of those conditions could be you can have slaves or you're not going to have slaves.
Right.
So they could sort of set ground rules as long as once the state was in, they didn't interfere with what the state did. That was a great source of controversy in the early to mid 19th century. Because each side, now you correct me if I'm wrong, was essentially in an arms race, right? They wanted to keep some sort of majority of people and, of course, representation in Congress that would be on their side. But was there really much of a chance that even if all the new territories were free, that you'd get to the point where slavery could be amended out of the Constitution? I mean, mathematically speaking, I think you'd have had to add quite a few states before you could get to the point of having three quarters who were going to abolish slavery.
I think the argument largely was that slavery would become unprofitable. There would be so many excess slaves. Slave owners certainly, by their actions, seemed to believe this. They constantly wanted to press. They wanted to annex Texas, which would be a slave state.
They wanted new markets.
They wanted new markets for excess slaves.
So it wasn't just the demographics and the votes and the electoral college. Of course.
And they wanted to annex. There were moves to annex Cuba. Cuba had slavery under the Spanish. So they wanted to annex that to be part of the United States. They wanted to make sure that slavery had this natural market for selling surplus property as they viewed it.
Of course. And so if I'm a slave owner, and this is, I know, very offensive to speak of people as being property, but that was the thought. And so I get value out of my slaves from their labor, but I also get value when they reproduce.
Right.
And then, of course, because I'm such a compassionate fellow, I just sell children away from their mothers, and off they go, and they're another profit center for me. So that's why I want slavery to expand, is so I can sell more slaves.
And one of the paradoxical aspects of slavery in the United States is that, unlike South America, where there was almost no natural growth of slaves, in other words, the slaves were dying so fast in South America, they had to keep importing them. Mm-hmm. Fairly quickly after slavery began in the United States, slavery internally continued to grow. In other words, health conditions and reproductive rates kept up with and expanded the slave population, even without the international slave trade, which, as you said, was cut off 20 years after the Constitution was ratified. And there were, of course, exceptions. There was still smuggling going on. But by and large, by the 1830s and 40s, the slave population in the United States is growing by natural increase. It is not growing by importation.
And this makes even more sense. If we've banned the international slave trade, then at least in theory, I can't export my surplus slaves. I have to export them internally to a new territory or a new state that allows slavery. You have just taught me something. I had never, ever thought of that.
So Mississippi, Louisiana are huge markets for slaves in the antebellum period. Virginia is actually selling slaves away. Maryland is selling slaves away. And so the old fear of many African Americans enslaved in this period was being sold south. Well, the reason they were fearful of that was because that was such a common transition. In other words, if you're in Virginia, you're a planter, you've got more slaves than you need, you sell them to the ready market. The ready market is New Orleans. The ready market is Natchez. It's Texas.
My understanding has been that, as you said earlier, you know, South America, Central America, the Indies, and now Louisiana and Mississippi needed more slaves because the conditions there were so much more difficult, and there was a higher mortality rate. You're squinting, so maybe I'm not so correct.
That's definitely true, in as I understand it, in Central and South America. Mm-hmm. It's the dynamic more in Mississippi and Louisiana and Texas is they're opening up more and more lands to cash crops.
Okay.
So it's not as much we need more slaves because they're dying here. It's we need more slaves because we're opening more land, more plantations, more acres under cultivation. I mean, all in all, probably the conditions health-wise were not as good in Mississippi, Louisiana, Texas as they were in Virginia due to a variety of factors.
A lot more low swampland and
exactly.
A lot more heat.
Malaria, yellow fever, much more prevalent there, but certainly not. Virginia's not immune to that. One of the biggest yellow fever outbreaks that occurred in the 18th century was in Philadelphia.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Okay, so we're going after the Civil War. Lincoln feels constrained. All he feels he can do, really, is contain slavery by preventing its expansion. Now we understand more fully why the Southerners wanted this. So he comes into office, and immediately, Southern states start seceding.
Before he comes into office.
Before, exactly. So after he's been elected.
Right.
Before he gets into office, and they start seceding. How did he react to that?
Well, he was alarmed. Many supporters begged him to reassure Southerners, but he remained silent and steadfastly silent throughout that four-month period between his election and his inauguration, in part because, and I think rightly, he was convinced that anything new he said would be misrepresented. He had already made clear his positions. He'd made them clear repeatedly in his campaigns against Stephen Douglas in 1858, in other speeches and pronouncements that he'd made. So he said, I'm not going to make any more pronouncements that can be misrepresented. However, he was working behind the scenes. He was in favor of what was called the Corwin Amendment, which was an amendment that would have prevented Congress from amending the Constitution to interfere with the internal institutions in any state. Historians have criticized Lincoln for his support of what was called the Corwin Amendment, introduced by a congressman from Ohio. But basically, Lincoln believed it was already there. The power, or that prohibition was already there in the Constitution, and this amendment only made explicit what he understood was already there implicit. So in other words, it didn't concede anything. It just made more explicit this restriction against federal government action getting involved in the internal institutions of the states. And he supported it. And it's an irony, of course, of American history that if that had become the 13th Amendment, it would have been the 13th Amendment that protected slavery, whereas, of course, the 13th Amendment that we got in 1865 abolished slavery.
That is just remarkable. So it sounds like, although Lincoln himself was reticent, people on his side of the aisle were trying desperately to keep the Union together. Corwin Amendment was perhaps the most successful of a bunch of efforts that you described during your speech today. And yet this didn't mollify the seceding states, did it?
No, it didn't. And a few states did ratify the amendment after it went to the states, Illinois being one of them. I believe Kentucky also ratified it. But it only achieved four or five states ratified it because, of course, Civil War and the events just overtook the process.
Sure.
So it became a moot point.
Okay, so Lincoln is trying to preserve the Union. He's holding out or at least supporting these olive branches. I believe he was also conciliatory in his first inaugural speech. And all of these efforts did nothing. And that brings us back to the question that I posed toward the beginning of our discussion. With all of the attempts to reassure them and all the attempts to tell the Southern states, we're not going to take your slaves away from you, with all of the obstacles the Southern states faced in terms of waging war, they still decided to secede.
Well, let me qualify one thing you just said.
Okay, please.
You said that it didn't mean anything, all of his attempts at conciliation and so forth. We don't really know that. It didn't mean enough for the states that seceded. Uh-huh. But remember, and this is something that's easy to lose sight of, there were four or five Southern states, slave-owning states, that did not secede. Delaware, Maryland, Kentucky, Missouri, and depending on how you want to categorize the western part of Virginia, which became West Virginia in 1863, those areas didn't secede. I mean, technically Virginia did, but then West Virginia seceded from the seceders.
We did a whole episode on that. If you're interested in that very interesting story, go to the podcast site, but please go on.
So he at least convinced, perhaps, or played a role in convincing slave owners in those border slave states that even though this scary Republican had been elected president, we can protect slavery more effectively in the Union than we can protect it going out of the Union. At least that was the calculation of some slave owners in those Upper South slave states. So perhaps Lincoln's conciliation or reassurances did play some role in helping to retain those states, or at least, and the story in those states is very different from state mm-hmm. to state. Basically, Missouri erupts into civil war within civil war. Kentucky proclaims neutrality at the beginning, and then the Confederates make the mistake of violating that neutrality, which then forces Kentucky to stay in the Union. And Maryland is a different complicated case, but ultimately, those slave states did remain in the Union. And Lincoln himself believed that if he had lost Kentucky to the Confederacy, he wouldn't have been able to maintain the Union.
Maybe not. Okay, so you had, as you explained today in the lecture, a series of secessions. And you divide them into at least two phases. The first phase was perhaps the most hardcore.
Right.
And the fire eaters, as you described them, in South Carolina and perhaps elsewhere. That's where I think that idea of Southern honor and that very different perspective, that's where you mentioned it. So could you tell us a little bit about that? Why was that a motive for the fire eaters to secede?
Well, they believed that their rights were being violated and that this was an offense against their honor in ways that Northerners really didn't understand, because for Southerners, honor was about public affirmation of one's value, and they believed that when a president could be elected who didn't get the electoral votes of any Southern slaveholding state and wasn't even on the ballot in some Southern states, that their power in the national councils, in Congress, was slipping. And as you mentioned before, there had been all of these compromises throughout the history of the nation, which had very carefully tried. If you go back to the Missouri Compromise, you've got these balancing act that they're playing, especially in the Senate, between the number of slave states and the number of free states. And you've got Southerners counting three-fifths of their slave population for the purposes of representation, which gives them a disproportionate representation in the House of Representatives and the Electoral College. And you've had a series of presidents, Pierce and Buchanan especially, who are Northerners, but they have Southern principles called doughfaces. Then you have this fear on the part of white Southerners, especially hardcore Southerners, that their world, in effect, is slipping away. That not only are they losing their reputation in the national councils, but they're becoming irrelevant when you can elect a president without any votes from the Southern states.
Wow. Okay. So those are the hardcore people. It's mm-hmm. about honor and about their feeling of being disrespected.
And about slavery, I mean.
And about slavery, ultimately, of course. As an institution. And then there's a second group of states, the next band of states to the north, that are hesitating. And apparently it was when Lincoln called upon them to give volunteers to fight the Confederacy that they said, if we have to choose, we ain't choosing you, Abe.
Exactly. I mean, you have to recall that the secession convention that occurred in Virginia voted strongly against secession first. And this is after South Carolina has seceded. This is after the other Gulf states have seceded, Florida, Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana. They remain in the Union, and they remain committed to the Union. But when Lincoln issues a call for volunteers to put down the rebellion, Virginia, North Carolina, Arkansas, Tennessee say, we can't fight against our sister southern states. Right. And I don't want to imply that there's no sense of honor involved here, because there is as well. But it is very much a divided area. And then you get another band of slave states further north where that calculus is slightly different and slightly more in favor of union. It's not that people in Kentucky and Missouri and Maryland and Delaware are on Lincoln's team by any means. He didn't win any of those states. They're just not willing to take the step out of the union.
You're listening to your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Dan Stoll, the former director and editor of the Papers of Abraham Lincoln. He's a fascinating guy. And now it's time to finish our discussion with Dan Stoll, the former director and editor of the Papers of Abraham Lincoln. We were talking about the secession crisis and how it happened in stages.
Once the battle lines had been drawn, and once the decisions had been made whether to secede or not, or at least for the moment, Lincoln didn't give up his attempts to abolish slavery. What did he do with regard to the loyal slave states?
Well, for much of 1861 and 62, especially late 61 and the first half of 1862, Lincoln is desperately trying to get any support he can in the border slave states to adopt voluntary compensated emancipation with colonization. And
let's unpack that term there a little bit.
Yes. So first of all, this would be actions by the states. So Kentucky would have to decide to adopt a program of emancipation for Kentucky. So that avoids the constitutional issue, because this is not the federal government doing anything. This is Kentucky that had instituted the institution of slavery, abolishing it. Mm-hmm. Secondly, compensated means that the slave owners would receive a cash payment for their slaves, probably by the federal government. And there were certainly critics who believed that Congress couldn't pass such a law to make appropriations for such a purpose. And gradual meant that slaves would be emancipated over a period of time. Sometimes some programs suggested that when they became 21 years old or some certain age, then they would be free. So it would be for a certain number of years. So it might be 20 or 30 years. Now, Lincoln believed, and a lot of people criticize him for this, and I understand why, as a racist statement, he criticized him for this very slow approach. But he is desperately trying to find, he's trying to meet all of the objections. And some well-meaning people insisted that if you just free all of these enslaved African Americans, then you're going to have this huge pauper class, and there's going to be crime, and there's going to be chaos, social chaos. It's too much of a shock to the system, and they're not going to be able to fend for themselves because we've always cared for them, and so forth. So there's absolutely a racist undertone to this, that African Americans can't fend for themselves. But there's also a recognition that this system has been in place for so many decades, for all of these people's lives. All white and black people alive at this point have only known this system, that it would just be too much of a shock and too socially chaotic for it to just disappear overnight. Obviously, later we now have the hindsight view of the 13th Amendment and the Emancipation Proclamation. And even then, we have to recognize it wasn't smooth.
Reconstruction era was not smooth. It still isn't
smooth. And it still isn't smooth. So
okay, so he's trying to do this gradual program. The last part of it was colonization. Was that the idea, is that they're going to ship them back to Africa? Or
well,
ship them to Africa? Most of them had never been in Africa.
Of course. Almost none of them had been in Africa. Right. The problem is that a lot of people look at that program, that idea, that policy, and they say it's deportation, that they're going to ship them somewhere. Lincoln never supported deportation. This was voluntary colonization. So African Americans who wanted to leave, and he believed, and people understandably consider this a racist statement, and you can certainly view it that way, he believed they would be better off separated from the white race. And to me, I look at that as more of an indictment of white racism than I do of African American ability. But
yeah, you could look at it that way.
You can look at it either way. Mm-hmm. And I can understand the validity of each argument, and it may be that it's both. But he believed, and he tried to convince leaders of the African American community to separate voluntarily because he said it would be better for you and for us. And I think he honestly believed that. And he may have been completely wrong, but he honestly believed that and was trying to do what he thought would be better. Today, that's not very popular, obviously, and so he is taking criticism for that as well. But that is was his policy, was voluntary colonization, either in Africa or in Central America. He made several efforts to establish colonies in Central America where African Americans could relocate and effectively create their own republic.
And these efforts essentially went nowhere, with one exception, right?
They largely went nowhere. I mean, Liberia is perhaps the exception on the coast of Africa, but it had its problems as well. A lot of African Americans did relocate there. A lot of them died there from mm-hmm. disease.
The policy also was a failure in the border states. Nobody picked up on them, except, again, for that one exception in Washington, D.C., which was entirely federal.
Exactly.
So that's one place that Lincoln could get his plan enacted. Did it work well there?
It worked.
Uh-huh.
I don't know about well, but it worked. There were all sorts of complications because, even with a very small slave population, they had to set up commissioners. They did pay some slaveholders, but they had to be careful that people from Maryland didn't sneak across and say, hey, these are my slaves. So it had to be within the District of Columbia. And that took a lot of paperwork and a lot of hearings and so forth. And it did free some slaves. But again, it was kind of overtaken by the broader process. But he got nowhere with the actual slave states. It was only that the District of Columbia is governed by the federal government, and he had a Republican majority in Congress.
So those were his efforts through 1862, much of it. But then the war started happening, and emancipation started kind of happening of its own accord, didn't it?
Well, it certainly did. I mean, there's no doubt that there is self-emancipation going on. The African Americans fleeing to Union lines causes all sorts of problems, and I use that term very loosely. Yeah. It causes problems for the army because they didn't know how to deal with it. Ultimately, they figured out how to deal with it, and they managed to employ African Americans to as support initially, support services for the military, and then ultimately, obviously, as combat troops as well. But that's getting a little ahead of the story. And it was an attorney who first came up with the idea of considering them contraband of war. The story goes that some slaves, I guess, stole a boat and rowed to Fortress Monroe in Virginia, southeastern Virginia, which was still held by the federal government. And the commander there at the time wasn't exactly sure what to do with them, but he was anti-slavery. Mm-hmm. And he decided to consider them contraband of war, and he passed that up the chain. And it sort of struck a positive note with the Secretary of War and with Lincoln. And so that became the new policy, is to treat them as contraband of war, much as a horse or foodstuffs or mm-hmm. weaponry or whatever might be captured from the enemy. Except that this, unlike the horses and the weapons and the foodstuffs, this property moved of its own volition. And so it was coming to them.
One of the reasons I love this is yes. because of the audacity of the Southern commander. He actually rode up under a flag of truce, very politely saluted and said, you know, sir, I believe you have some of my property. I'd like you to return it. And the Union commander said, well, let me think about it. And the Union commander, now this is a plug for my profession, he's a lawyer by profession, mm-hmm. so he thinks about it, and he comes up with this idea. You Southerners call these people property. If I return them to you, you're going to put them, enlist them as part of the war effort, or at least they're going to support your economy, right. and therefore, just like a wagon or a horse or anything else you consider property, I'm not going to return them to you. If I capture your wagon, I'm not giving it back. And that's what he told the Southern commander, who was no doubt rather upset by this. But then that theory really captured Lincoln's imagination as yeah. it went up the chain.
It's using Confederates' categorization of enslaved people as property against them. A couple of commanders decided that they could, under their own military authority, emancipate slaves that were being used against them, either by building fortifications or even just growing foodstuffs that fed the Confederate armies, that they could emancipate those slaves in their areas, in Missouri and in Georgia and South Carolina. And Lincoln ultimately had to quash those emancipation efforts. And that caused him no end of grief with the abolitionists. They were outraged that he would turn against emancipation efforts in this way. But he did so for very clear reasons, and that is, first of all, he didn't believe that they had the authority to do it, even as a military endeavor, but also that if anyone was going to do the emancipation or issue an emancipation kind of proclamation, that was going to have to be him as president.
They were just getting ahead of them.
They were getting ahead of
them. Things were moving quickly, commanders in the field, reasonable decisions, even compassionate decisions, but if anyone's going to do it, I'm going to do it because I'm the president.
Exactly.
Okay, so now Lincoln has to wrestle with this idea. Does he have the constitutional authority under his Article II powers, and specifically his war powers,
right.
to seize this contraband of war, this human contraband, and then do more than simply keep it behind his lines for the duration of the war, but actually declare that these people are free?
Yes. And he ultimately wrestles with the chief contradiction. The Constitution protects this institution. The Constitution forbids the federal government from interfering with the institutions, any institutions, in the states because of the concept of federalism. But ultimately, this is an institution that is supporting a rebellion against the government. And if I am going to do all that I can to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution, and in case of war, I have additional powers that I wouldn't have in peacetime. And so again, we have the Confederates kind of hoisted on their own petard in the sense that they've begun a war, a rebellion, and that gives their arch enemy, Abraham Lincoln, additional powers under the Constitution that he wouldn't have had had they stayed in the Union and continued to advocate for slavery. I don't think that Lincoln would have been able to act against slavery had the states remained in the Union.
Secession and war is starting to look like more and more of a mistake for the Southern states. I mean, if they'd simply stuck around, they might have been able to preserve that institution indefinitely.
Yeah, exactly. They might not have been able to expand it because the Republicans had said, we're not going to expand this into new states and territories.
But they've been able to do it through compromise up to that point.
Exactly.
And what's to say they couldn't do it, especially if they'd gotten so close to war, then the North might have been even more in a compromising mood. So they blew their chance at compromise and conciliation. And then they handed Lincoln all these extra powers. And it took him a while. To really feel that way, because then this gets to the essence of what you're talking about. He's a lawyer. He knows about the law. He believes in the rule of law. In fact, he thinks the rule of law is what makes us different from all other nations.
Right.
And the president has to follow the rule of law. But now it looks like maybe the rule of law is giving him a bit more room.
It is.
Because it's wartime.
It is. Okay. And so ultimately he makes a proclamation, although it's important to recognize all the limitations of this proclamation. First of all, he makes a preliminary proclamation. He doesn't just proclaim, okay, everybody in the rebellion, all the slaves in the rebellious states are free now. He gives them 100 days, gives the Confederates 100 days to come back into the Union. Anybody who comes back into the Union, they can keep their slaves as a state. Of course, no one does, but he did give them 100 days. And then on January 1st, he issues the Emancipation Proclamation, which frees the slaves in areas of states and states then in rebellion.
And that's key, because that keeps the loyal states happy, or at least,
exactly.
At least doesn't offend them.
So he does not emancipate slaves in Kentucky or Maryland or Missouri or Delaware, or even West Virginia. He also doesn't, and this is also important, he also doesn't emancipate slaves in Tennessee, in parts of Virginia, and parts of Louisiana that are under Union Army control, because the whole argument is necessity. It is the necessity that gives him the war power to emancipate the slaves. So if the Union Army controls these areas, then the necessity argument doesn't work. So he's immediately criticized, especially by abolitionists and by historians since, for emancipating slaves over which he has no control, and not emancipating slaves over which he has control. And unfortunately, I think that misses two very important points. First of all, it misses the point of the argument that this is done as a military necessity. And so therefore, it's not something that he is just doing because he wants to, because he thinks it's the right thing to do. He's doing it as a war measure. So naturally, freeing slaves in Kentucky, it's hard to make that a war measure,
right?
Because Kentucky is still in the Union.
In fact, it might be the opposite.
Exactly.
If that's the system there, and those the slaves in Kentucky are producing important food for
right.
the Union Army.
Right. And it also misses the moral power, I think, of the Emancipation, which is Emancipation Proclamation, which is that it changes the nature of the war effort from one for Union alone to Union and liberty. And that's very important to some soldiers. It's not as important to others. There's no doubt about that. But it's very important in foreign eyes, though. And it really pretty much ends any chance that that Great Britain or France, the two main nations that would be inclined to do so, will intervene on the side of the Confederacy, or even intervene as a alleged neutral third party to try to broker some kind of peace.
So it's good PR.
It's very good international PR.
Let's just briefly touch upon why Lincoln was so eager to have the 13th Amendment passed. I mean, he'd already proclaimed the slaves free, so what's the hurry? What's the problem?
Well, the Emancipation Proclamation, and Lincoln was a good enough lawyer to recognize this, the Emancipation Proclamation was limited. It did free 3.1 million slaves, but that's not all the slaves in the United States. And it's a war measure. So what happens when the war is over? And will the courts actually agree with Lincoln that it is a necessity, that he even has the authority to do this?
You pointed out that this was more or less the same Supreme Court that had decided Dred Scott a few years earlier, the same Chief Justice.
Yeah. Absolutely. It also didn't affect children born to slaves. So a child born to slaves on January 2nd, 1863... The Emancipation Proclamation has nothing to say about that.
Oh, my. You sound like a lawyer now. Well,
I'm sorry.
You born, young man?
Exactly. Okay. So it doesn't affect them because it would be an ex post facto law. Anyway, it wouldn't affect them because the proclamation freed those slaves in those areas at that time. So the 13th Amendment is a, as Lincoln called it, a king's cure for all the evils, because it amends the Constitution itself. It goes directly to the central governing document, to the central source of Lincoln's ethical dilemma, which is the Constitution itself. The 13th Amendment basically winds up the whole thing by saying slavery will not exist in the United States. It passes the Senate fairly quickly in 1864, but it fails in the House. It has to have a two-thirds majority, and it fails in the House largely along party lines, Democrats and Republicans. It does not pass in June of 1864. Then we have the election of 1864. Lincoln wins pretty handily, definitely an overwhelming victory in the Electoral College. He actually gets more than half of the popular vote, which he had not in 1860. He comes to his fourth annual message to Congress in December of 1864, and he pleads with the House of Representatives, the lame duck House of Representatives, which is almost evenly divided between Republicans and Democrats. There are a few more Republicans and Democrats, but definitely not a two-thirds majority, pleads with them to pass the 13th Amendment so that it can go to the states for ratification. And as anyone who's seen Steven Spielberg's Lincoln from 2012 will know, Lincoln is very passionate about getting them to pass this legislation. And he uses all sorts of arguments. He insists that the election itself, which has returned a huge Republican majority for the next Congress that will begin serving in March, has given the will of the people. And he argues and he cajoles and he offers offices to some of these Democratic members of Congress who are lame ducks. They're not going to be in the next Congress. And ultimately, they persuade enough of them so that on January 31st, 1865, the 13th Amendment passes the House of Representatives by a two-thirds majority with two votes to spare. And then it gets sent out immediately the next day to the states for ratification. And I believe 18 states ratify it in that month, in February 1865. But it is not fully, enough states have not ratified it until December 1865. And sadly, Lincoln does not live to see the 13th Amendment become part of the U.S. Constitution.
Now, just before we finish here, why was he in such an all-fired hurry to have that Congress send it out to the states, since he knew he was going to get a much more friendly Congress in about 2 months?
I think he believed that any blow against slavery, including this, would undermine the Confederate war effort. It goes back to his argument in 1862 that he would save the Union as quickly as possible.
So he was getting a little bit impatient at this point.
He was getting impatient, and he felt, I don't want to get overly melodramatic, but he felt the loss of hundreds of thousands of young men in this war.
And anything
And they were dying every day.
That's
and
right.
Anything he could do to shorten that, if he could shorten that by 2 months, he could save tens of thousands of lives, potentially. So he wanted it sent to the states so that it could be ratified, so it become a part of the Constitution, and basically cut out from under the Confederacy what he considered to be the main pillar supporting them.
So in sum, Lincoln is ethically constrained by the law. He pushes the boundaries of the law, and then ultimately, he changes the law.
He
does. So now, ethically, he can abolish slavery, along with the rest of the nation. Well, Daniel Sowell, thank you so very much. You have enlightened me in so many areas and answered so many interesting questions, so we really appreciate your expertise today.
Happy to do it.
And that's our show. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by Hannibal's Elephants. Check them out on Spotify. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment.